damn late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
Well, it's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again, you've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, and died.
Well, we ain't killing they army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, bitch, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, on the line, I've got Danny Scherson, regular contributor at antiwar.com, formerly a major in the U.S. Army, did combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan during both surges, and very conscientious objector, figuratively, if not literally, from the Army. And here is latest for antiwar.com, which actually originally appeared at Truth Dig, but we reprinted all along with his original articles for us. We're listening to the wrong voices on Syria. Welcome back, Danny. How you doing?
Hey, Scott. Good to be back.
Good to have you here. Let's talk about Afghanistan first. I don't know what the hell is going on, honestly. The Washington Post says that Donald Trump has given in to Lindsey Graham and that now the withdrawal from Afghanistan is going to be a reduction of troop force levels back to where they were when he was sworn in at right around 10,000 instead of 15. I guess it'll be 9 instead of 16 or whatever it is. So the Washington Post article seems to imply that the Taliban have agreed to that. But does that sound right to you? Or what is going on here? Is the deal off?
I'm not in the negotiation room, certainly. But I cannot imagine the Taliban giving way and allowing us to keep 10,000 troops. I mean, they have all the high cards right now. They're, you know, I called it in one of my latest articles a talk and shoot policy. And that was exactly the word they used for the North Vietnamese policy during the peace negotiations. They would keep ratcheting up the violence. They would keep changing the facts on the ground in a more positive way for themselves in order to gain leverage at the negotiating table, which is a brilliant strategy as an insurgency or as the weaker power. And the Taliban has done that marvelously. I mean, people who study military insurgencies are going to study the Taliban because that's how effective they've been.
Right.
And why in the world would they say, okay, we'll agree to peace and let 10,000 Americans stay? No way. That's not going to happen. There is no chance. But the thing I want to say about it, if the Lindsey Graham thing is true, if Trump, because Trump wants to get out of Afghanistan, I think he really does. I mean, the guy is so inconsistent. But you know, in The Godfather, you know, I think it's Godfather 2, you know, he's like, just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in.
Yeah.
That's what the policy in Afghanistan for Trump has been. Because every time he lets us think we're about to get out, and I think he really wants it, somebody, whether it's the Boltons or the Grahams or the McMasters or the Mattises or the Dunfords of the world, they pull him right back into a conventional interventionist forever war policy.
Yep. And, you know, I really think it's true that he thinks this just because he tweeted about it for years before he was elected. I don't think he actually used the word Afghanistan once during the campaign, but certainly on Twitter, at one point in 2012, he took Obama's side. The hated Barack Obama, born in Kenya, secret Muslim terrorist that he got elected on the back of. He took Obama's side in telling the generals to back off of their pressure trying to get Obama to extend the deadline for the surge drawdown. And Obama was saying, no, we had a deal 2012, and now it's 2012. And the generals were saying, no, give us a few more years. And Trump started tweeting that these generals ought to shut up and back down and do what the commander-in-chief says because he's right, we got to get out of there. And he was just so consistent on that. But then as soon as he became president, he was like, oh, well, geez, I guess I've been told better by my people. But wait, one more thing. Was a couple more. You're right. You got to be right that he wants out of there even still as president, because even though he did surge 10,000 in there, He also really, I think, rejected McMaster and Mattis's strategy of escalation and four more years of fighting and try to deal with them then, which was what McMaster wanted. Instead, he sent Zalmay Khalilzad over there with a mandate, clearly, with a severe mandate, one that Khalilzad has taken to heart for, you know, a couple of years now, that he should really pursue a deal with the Taliban. I mean, all of that would have fallen apart a long time ago, right? If the president himself had not said, no, really, seriously, I got your back. You work for me. I want this done. You're the guy to do it. Do it. Otherwise, just from what I know of reading stupid old Bob Woodward books about administrations and things, special envoys don't keep envoying if they don't really know that they work directly for the president and have a real mandate to do those kinds of things. And so here we are in the summer of 2019, and they're talking about they have the deal. They're ready to sign it any day now and all of this kind of stuff. So they've seen it through this far. But then, yeah. I guess you can just flip-flop right back again. Lindsey Graham says 9/11 will happen again if we leave, Danny.
Well, I mean, that's the same old tired arguments from the same old tired old man thinkers. I mean, it's absolutely insane. It's actually Orwellian to a certain extent. I'll tell you, the Orwellian news article I saw the other day, and I tweeted it out, was it's the headline, and like it was like the Times or the Post, was like, top general says it's too early to talk about withdrawal from Afghanistan. It's Dunford, right? The chief of staff.
Yeah, no precipitous withdrawals.
I mean, when you use the word too early to describe an 18-year war, that's an Orwellian. It's like we're back in Oceania, 1984. It's not war. It's too soon. 18 is early. Like, what? How? Don't we have to be careful with our language even? How could you say it's too early to leave 18 years into a war? I mean, it's a shocking number. The fact that we have people that are that stuck in the box with those just totally useless ideas that have been discredited for two decades, the fact that we still have a guy like that at the top of our military is like so instructive about why we should never trust generals.
Yeah. And you know what? It's been the former and current head of CENTCOM, or the previous, I should say, and current head of CENTCOM, and the previous and the current general in charge of the wars, all four of these men have said, we're not leaving. We can't leave. I don't care what Trump told you. Forget it. Essentially, they've been saying that for months.
It makes me wonder if they all have like beautiful timeshares there or something. Like maybe they're investing in the long term. You know,
there are some really nice mansions in Kabul, I heard.
Yeah, paid for with drug money. You know, maybe they're playing the long game. We just don't know it. I mean, these guys are insane. But, you know, part of it is the military culture. These guys, I mean, I was joking about timeshares. Many of these generals have actually spent 4, 5, 6 years in Afghanistan over the course of their careers, rotating in and out, because a lot of times generals stay longer than a year in top positions. I mean, they don't know anything but counterinsurgency or whatever the fuck this is. They don't know anything else. Their careers were built on the war on terror. The entire foundation of their careers is the war on terror. If you pulled the rug out from under them, I'm telling you, these guys, intellectually, culturally, identity-wise, they wouldn't know what to do with themselves. They wouldn't. I mean, that's the scary reality of a military that's been in imperial wars for 20 years.
Yeah. Well, and here's the real hard part of this one. USA lost this, and you can't spin it otherwise. And, I mean, who believes there will really be a peace deal between the Taliban and the current Kabul government? And who believes that the current Kabul government could even be the Kabul government if America didn't give them $50 billion a year?
Well, yeah, there's some really inconvenient facts and statistics that you know very well from writing the book that bolster our argument for withdrawal. I mean, you know, the tax base, the budget, right, the annual budget of the Kabul government can't even support its own defense forces. I mean, it doesn't have enough money to pay for its cops and its air force and its army. I mean,
yeah, much less any of the rest of the government at all.
Leaving aside the real functions of government, it can't even sustain its security state, and it's a militarist security state, of course, by its nature. I mean, this war would have to literally go on forever in a stalemate with America backing it with whatever 10, 20,000 and a lot of Air Force. And then this entire thing, look, it ends the same way whether we leave yesterday, in 6 months, or in 60 years. This game ends the same way. Kabul falls or it holds on to a sliver of the Northeast. I mean, that's how this thing ends. That's it. Well, all we're doing is delaying it, causing more death, and, you know, burying a couple of Americans every few weeks.
Yeah. Well, it's an important point, too, that the Taliban cannot defeat the U.S. any more than the U.S. can defeat the Taliban there. Danny Davis one time explained to me that if every Taliban in the country descended on the Bagram air base, there's enough firepower in that air base to tear those guys apart like Verdun in World War One or what have you. They don't have the air power. They don't have the ability. They'll never have the ability to challenge America's presence at that base as long as the Americans are determined to keep it. But so that just means, from the point of view of those generals we were talking about, great. We don't have to lose the war. Scott Horton's wrong. We lost the war. We don't have to lose the war. As long as we're holding on to our one base and we can do drone attacks and keep the Taliban from marching on Kabul, then we hadn't lost yet. And hey, Danny just said maybe we could put this off another 20 years. Let's do that. Then it'll be somebody else's fault entirely.
These guys are never going to admit defeat. I mean, the dirty secret that you and I know is the war is, like you said, it's already been lost. And by any like rational examination of the definition of victory, this thing's been lost, right? But you're right. We can maintain an Alamo at Bagram Air Base and create like an air, you know, like a safe zone, like an air safe zone over basically Kabul and the suburbs indefinitely. But is that victory? I mean, one more point. So Mattis wrote this like, you know, supposedly amazing op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. I just gave it I just talked to a reporter about it yesterday, and I just tore up Mattis, which is one of my favorite things to do because he's like a sacred cow and I love to slaughter him. But, you know, look at Mattis. Okay. They put this guy on a pedestal, but his career, beyond the fact that he's been wrong about every American intervention for two decades, when you look at his career, if you're honest, it's failure. He failed at everything he did. He failed in Iraq. Yeah, he won a tactical victory in Fallujah, but Fallujah was back in the hands of ISIS years later. He lost in Iraq. He lost repeatedly in Afghanistan. The whole Marja government in a box thing was a joke. McChrystal lost there. Mattis and the Marines lost in Helmand. It's a career of failure, and it's not just Mattis. It's Dunford, and it's an entire generation of American generals.
And David Petraeus.
The biggest loser of all. Right?
The great American fraud.
Yeah. Yeah,
the fact that he would write in the Wall Street Journal, oh, geez, we can't leave now. Wait, you said you were going to bring the Taliban to the table to deal on your terms by July of 2012, 7 years ago. He can't even deputize someone else to write this stupid article. It has to be the guy who lost the war, you know, himself.
Yeah.
He's his own best poster boy.
Yeah, the only reason Petraeus is still a national voice, despite all his discrediting behavior and failures, is because he's the best PR general since, you know, I don't know, Patton. I mean, he's or MacArthur. The guy sells himself. He's good with words. He's fairly articulate. He just says all the wrong words articulately. Like, I don't know why we're so impressed with him. He is a PR scam artist. That's all the guy is. And the fact that Americans are bought and sold on the whole, not just Petraeus, but this worship of the generals, I've written about it so many times, I'm tired of writing about it. This is really, really unhealthy in a republic, if that's what we still are.
Oh, yeah. Well, and of course, he made it clear many times for years that he wanted to run for president of the United States. There was even talk of him challenging Obama in 2012. And, you know, nobody ever minded that he lost two wars. He's still the world's greatest general in history. The fact that he lost two wars notwithstanding, it's not even considered. The only trouble he got in was passing above top secret level secrets to hose.
You're absolutely right. You know, I think Obama made an interesting movie. I mean, it was highly political and it was stupid. And the Obama surge was one of the great disasters of his presidency. But, you know, you say like Petraeus had these presidential ambitions maybe for 2012. So McChrystal gets himself fired, right? And I thought it was a brilliant move by Obama politically. Mm-hmm. He takes Petraeus and demotes him, right, from the head of, you know, CENTCOM and says, hey, go down and command the war in Afghanistan. I really need you, Dave. The country needs you, which basically gets him stuck in this morass where he's going to be so busy, he's not going to be able to run for president. You know, I thought it was a great political move.
Right. Obama, yeah, and also, you're not going to run against me blaming me for not carrying out your policy. I'm putting you in charge, godfather of coin. Never mind your assistant, McChrystal. You're now going to be the one in charge of making this work. And when it doesn't work, it's going to be your fault just as bad as mine. And so screw you, which... You know, Obama should have just fired him in the first place. And the fact that he gave in to these guys in 2009 shows that he is a Trump-level weakling. And vice versa, yeah. These guys. If I was the president, I would give a speech where I would say, I don't care if the generals murder me. You guys can try. You can murder me. I got private security, but you can try. But my orders are to end the war. American people, do you side with your elected president or these generals who want to refuse to leave a war that they already lost to their pathetic, ridiculous shame? You know? And who cares? I mean, seriously, if you're the president of the United States, you're not willing to take a risk to do the right thing? I would. I wouldn't care at all. Same if I was a senator, man. If I was a senator, I would raise hell until they drown me somewhere.
I agree, man. I think the only way to, like, effectively end these wars in some – I mean, he could do it tomorrow with an executive order, basically, but because we don't declare a war anymore. But, I mean, I think Trump should go to the people, like you said. Because, yes, the establishment – D.C., Washington, military-industrial complex, blah, 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 media, they're all going to keep the war inertia going. So you got to do an end run. You got to throw a Hail Mary over them, get on national television, do stump speeches around the country, go on a Wilson, Woodrow Wilson-type tour of America, and appeal to the people and say, listen, you guys elected me to end these wars. I know from polling and from the pulse of the people that you guys think this is bullshit. So follow me, and I will lead us to peace. If Trump did that, not only would his people rally around him because they'd rally around him no matter what he did, but he'd put the progressive left, right, his alleged opponents, in a difficult position,
right,
where the grassroots – I mean, you know, Rachel Maddow will flip-flop and say that we need to stay in Afghanistan forever, but even though she wrote a book to the opposite effect. But, you know, I think that the progressive grassroots would ultimately have to go along, would ultimately have to agree. I mean, maybe they wouldn't like it, but if he goes to the people, you know – it makes it a lot harder and less palatable for the generals to pull this bullshit. You know, it makes it a lot harder.
Yeah, it's not even that, too. It's also that he, because we know how the Democratic Party will react. They'll react exactly as predicted, like a bunch of Hillary Clintons, as they have this whole time over Russiagate and whatever, and accuse him of selling out the military and selling out America's interests and being insufficiently patriotic and all this, and attack him from the right in the worst way. And which would just... there's no way that they can get, you know, they liberals and Democrats, they might be able to get their people to be silent during Obama times on the wars, but they're never going to turn Democratic voters into a bunch of Dick Cheneys over that. And it's not like they necessarily would take Trump's side, but they're not going to be impressed by a bunch of Democrats running to Trump's right. And not only that, but there's like 10 wars going on. So he could end a war every couple of months from now until Election Day. He'd be Trump the Great. It'd be easy. And as you said, Congress can't get in his way. He could end it all by executive order. You know, he could do it all. He could end Afghanistan, get us out of Syria, get us out of Iraq, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, Mali, Niger, whatever you got. He could stop arming Ukraine. He could pull our troops out of Lithuania. He'd be Trump the Great in no time.
I'm imagining like a wheel. You know, he's a showman, right? There should be like a wheel with like all like 15 or 16 of our ground troop wars, or 30 of them, right? And he should spin a wheel once a month on national television.
Yeah, you make know a big mean? I mean, game out of it.
Ratings.
Yeah.
It would be the ultimate reality show. And it would be like, whoa, Niger.
Let Kim Jong-un sleep in the Lincoln bedroom, you know?
If he was to end one of these wars every few months, I mean, I'm joking about the wheel, but if he were to just end it, it would be really interesting. How would history then cast his legacy? Because it would be even more complicated. So I don't.
He'd be
like
a treasonous isolationist who destroyed everything and set the stage for the next Hitler.
But is that what the historians would say? I mean, would the liberal historians say that? I mean, yes, the pundits would say that. But I mean, when his legacy was out later, you know, the relatively progressive historians who dominate the historical business, I mean, would they give him credit? I don't know.
I think they probably would have to. In the way that they say about Nixon, that, well, Nixon was Nixon and everything, but at least he went to China, that kind of deal,
right.
Détente with the Russians.
Hey, and if only Nixon can go to China, I've said it 1,000 times, maybe only Trump can go to Kabul and, you know, Damascus and you name it.
Yeah, except here's the thing about it. He's a bad person. And not only that, he's lazy. And so he won't even take the time to figure out who he needs nearby to help take his side against Lindsey Graham. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
He's, well, geez, I don't know. If Lindsey Graham and John Bolton and Mike Pompeo agree about something, who am I to disagree with that? Because that's all he's got. And so,
again, Lindsey Graham, wrong on every foreign policy issue since he's been in the Senate, as far as I know.
And the least popular senator in America, too, right? There's no reason to have to go along with that. And here's the other irony, back to the whole actual situation that we're talking about here in Afghanistan, where Lindsey Graham says, no, we can't leave because if we do, that'll cause a 9/11. Well, it was occupying the Middle East is what caused 9/11. It's not having a lack of troops in Afghanistan. It was having troops in Saudi Arabia, particularly the U.S. Air Force that was being used to bomb and blockade the people of Iraq for a full decade leading up to September 11th is what caused it. Then secondly, bin Laden's plan was to make us overreact and to lure us into a long-term engagement in Afghanistan that he knew we couldn't win. And just like a good Leninist, his idea was, however many Afghans have to die in the effort, who cares? Because over the long run, the American empire will go bankrupt and be forced to withdraw, just like the USA helped them do to the Soviet Union in the 1980s. And so let's replicate that. It's bin Laden and Zawahiri who want Lindsey Graham to make Donald Trump stay in Afghanistan. And then there's the whole joke about Afghanistan being some kind of magic portal to Boston Logan Airport instead of the furthest place you can get from anywhere before you're headed back the other way again.
Right, yes,
it's exile. It's no man's land. How the hell? The only reason they were able to do September 11th is because they recruited Egyptian graduate students studying in Germany to get into the United States. They didn't launch the Afghan Air Force. They had to hijack our planes to even have a weapon to crash in anything, for God's sake.
Absolutely. I mean, and it's a really symbiotic relationship between the extremist Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri kind of thing, and the Lindsey Grahams of the world. I mean, these people are
bootleggers and Baptists, right?
And they need each other. They need each other. And the crazy thing is, bin Laden wrote this stuff down, and he said it. Like, he wasn't hiding his plan. What he discussed, like, when he declared war on us and listed his three reasons, and when he started making statements about drawing the United States into a new, like, Soviet-style Afghan crusade in the Middle East, he wrote this down. It's like his Mein Kampf. Hitler told us what he was going to do, and then he did it. Well, bin Laden told us what he was going to do, and we fell for it. Like, we just went right into his trap. So bin Laden's dead under, I think, very interesting circumstances we could talk about in some other time. But bin Laden's dead, but bin Laden's ideas won.
Yeah, no question about it. And, you know, and by the way, people always get mad at me when I talk about, you know, the Americans essentially falling for bin Laden's plan, and that somehow acquits George Bush and makes him just a fool and not a mass murderer or this kind of thing. But really what it is that, you know, bin Laden was not a Taliban caveman from the town of Bedrock out there in Afghanistan. He was a son of a billionaire and had a PhD in engineering and was a very worldly and political guy. And he knew that, you know, he had essentially a pretty accurate estimate of the empire that he was up against. And he wasn't just trying to fool innocent, doe-eyed George Bush into doing something foolish. He was trying to give George Bush an excuse, a crisis to exploit that he would cynically take advantage of and do the wrong thing, knowing that what George Bush thinks is good for him in the short term is ultimately bad for the American empire in the long term. And so, in other words, he knew that Bush wanted to get away with blue bloody murder, and so he was providing Bush an excuse to exploit, which makes Bush just as much America's enemy as Osama bin Laden is. It doesn't make him an innocent, doe-eyed fool. It makes him, you know, a horrible, blood-soaked fool is what it does, you know? But people always think it's got to be so black and white and gray, and that if he's a fool, then he's innocent. But no, the plan was, you know, based on the idea of what a cynical and cruel and fake tough guy he was, right? That's what bin Laden's son said to Rolling Stone when he saw Bush come in with all of his tough guy posturing, that bin Laden was thrilled that Bush had been, you know, that the Supreme Court had given the election to Bush, not Gore, because here's a guy who will overreact. Here's a guy who will exploit to the nth degree and fall right into the trap.
And I think what you just described accurately is the real 9/11 truth. I mean, it's not about whether jet fuel can, you know, can melt steel beams. It's not about that.
Right.
The real 9/11 truth is what you described. It's that symbiotic relationship between the neoconservative militarist monsters in America and the Al-Qaeda monsters in Afghanistan and throughout the Arab world. I mean, that's the real 9/11 truth. The real crime isn't that, oh, the government, you know, stepped in and blew up these buildings on September 11th. No, the real truth goes back, like you're describing, to, you know, 1979 and, you know, all the ways that the United States not only enabled bin Laden to exist and become powerful, but also the way that the two sides, they just understood each other. I mean, you're right. Bin Laden knew that Bush was just the right guy. And they are, and you're right, they're equally enemies of the state. They are equally enemies of the American people. Someone needs to say that in power. And I feel like Trump could. Like, I hate to keep praising this bad guy, but, like, I'm not praising him. I just think Trump is capable of – he doesn't give – like, if he wasn't so lazy and if he actually cared, he could go to the American people and be like, let me tell you the story of 9/11, why this happened, and why we got to make sure this never happens again, how we're going to make sure it never happens again, and America is going to not play into these guys' hands and we're getting out of the Middle East. I think the American people would buy that.
Yeah, of course, especially now. But – I mean, that's the whole thing. They had their chance when Ron Paul ran in 2008 and 2012. But now there's nobody else like that. And, you know, the best Democrat ain't going to do it. Even Tulsi Gabbard is a hawk 2/3 of the time. So,
yeah, the sad thing is that if Tulsi Gabbard is a hawk 2/3 of the time, and you might be right about that, what hope do we have? Because she's the—I mean, she's the best out there, I think, on foreign policy. I guess her and Bernie, but, like, I mean, neither of them is perfect. You're right. I mean, we don't have a Ron Paul out there, and I also think that if we're gonna have a Ron Paul, if we're gonna have a person who really, really is truly anti-war consistently, I think it has to come from the right, because I just don't think that the left is I'm of the left more than you, of course, but I don't think the left is the party that's gonna be able to turn these wars on their head and just upend U.S. policy. For some reason, I just have this instinct or this hunch that it has to come from the right.
Yeah. Well, and not just from the right, because I think, you know, I hate to say it, but Rand Paul is such a kind of wimpy character with his little turtleneck sweater and all of this stuff that I think in that sense, he might as well be a Democrat. What we need is, you know, Nixon, when people say Nixon can go to China, it's not just that he was a Republican, even though he really was a liberal Republican on domestic policy in a million ways, but he was known as a hardcore anti-communist hawk. And so that was why it was his, you know, faux tough guy status from the right that made it, you know, it was the irony of the whole thing that made it doable for him to seek detente with Russia and China. But and so then that's the same advantage that Donald Trump has, too, is that he has this whole faux macho posturing about just what a right winger and just what a nationalist and just what a super patriot he is. And so it would be the irony of the thing that, wowee, Donald Trump went to Tehran and shook hands with the Ayatollah and said, let's work these things out. After all, Jimmy Carter can only screw up world history for so long, right? Come on. And then, but even with somebody like Rand Paul, I don't know. I mean, if it had been Ron, it wouldn't have mattered. He would have just done it no matter what. But with Rand, he's just too impressionable. I could see Rand rolling over just like Obama and Trump on Afghanistan or anything else once the pressure was put to him, you know? So.
Yeah, I mean, it's
and
really
then who else is there? You say it's got to come from the right. Who else we got? Thomas Massie? He's just in the house.
Right, right. Oh, yeah, I've actually spoken to his chief of staff once when I was doing work with the defense priorities. I had a 30
He
minute.
Is really good, I think.
He is, yeah. His this woman, I forget her name, she was his chief, I think, and she gave me like 30 minutes and just let me rant, basically, which was, I mean, I don't know how much effect it had because I think we already had him in our pocket, but she was really amenable, and I mean, his record's pretty good. But yeah, he's in the House, and he's a Republican from Kentucky. Does he really have, you know, the potential to be a national figure? I don't know. They probably wouldn't let him, you know. That's the thing. Look how they're attacking Tulsi. Tulsi's not even, like you said, Tulsi's not even as Ron Paul-y as we'd like her to be, right? But because she says some, you know, seriously anti-war things, they're scared to death of her. It's amazing. Like, the amount, like, this woman is polling under 2%. But the attack on her shows that they will make sure anything that even smells of anti-interventionism, I mean, they're going to make sure that campaign is still born.
Yeah. Well, and you know what? It's her fault, too, because never mind the stuff that she's bad on, even the stuff that she's good on, when they attack her with this Assad stuff, she is letting them put her on the defensive, where it was correct, but she looked weak when she's protesting to MSNBC that, geez, this is all you guys ever ask me about, and it's getting to be like propaganda, and I've already answered this a few times and that kind of thing. That's totally the wrong position, like frustration with them not leaving her alone about it. That's not the right position. The right position is, let me tell you something, lady. Assad is fighting Al-Qaeda, okay? I don't like Assad, but I dislike Al-Qaeda more. Can you understand that? That, yes, I prefer the Syrian state control the Syrian state instead of a bunch of head-chopping suicide bombers just like me and my friends fought in Iraq War II, okay? And then the stupid lip gloss TV lady has to shut the hell up because she doesn't know, and she just got told. And so, oh, okay. And then you actually have a viral YouTube to pass around now, too. Tulsi shoves it back down their throat. But instead, she always goes, oh, come on, I was just trying to make peace or something that, in other words, she doesn't change the presumption of the narrative at all, that she's a bad guy for daring to meet with this bad guy. So it's like they're pitching her a slow ball, yeah. And she could be knocking it out of the park, but she just won't.
I would. I mean, you're absolutely right. She should go on the attack. She should go viral. I mean, I think she knows the things you said. I think she even believes the things you said, but she just doesn't know how to present it. And if she did, you're right. She'd be like, hey, guess what, guys? On the left, you guys don't like forever war, right? And you don't like Al-Qaeda. So Assad fights him. On the right, you guys love Christians, right? Especially Christians in the Middle East, as rare as they are. Well, guess what? Assad protects them. He always has. And so did Saddam, right? So, I mean, to me, it would be palatable to sort of like both wings of the people, right? If not the establishment. Like, yeah. Let Assad, the dictator, run Syria. He's not a threat to us. He protects minorities, and he fights Al-Qaeda. Doesn't mean I have to like the guy. Doesn't mean I wouldn't prefer, just for the sake of the Syrian people, that there was somebody who did those things that was also a Democrat and small d. But look, that's not the world. I take the world as it is.
Yeah.
That's what Tulsi should say. I take the world as it is, not as I wish it would be.
And
right?
Seriously, who the hell is the United States of America to let anyone be the sovereign leader of anything? You know, that's outside of our jurisdiction to say who gets to be the government of Syria or not. I mean, you know, not in reality. America's been overthrowing governments in Syria there since 1946. But I mean, according to the U.S. Constitution and according to the lessons of the last, just say, 8 years or the last 20, forget it. You'd be crazy to support an intervention against a Middle Eastern government after all of this now.
I'd like to see us go a step further. Like, I've got some radical ideas. Like, here's one. Like, let's have Trump, let him call like a conference, like an anti-terror conference, you know, like an alliance or a partnership, tacit. Like, invite Putin, invite Khomeini, or at least, you know, the civilian ruler, and say, and you know, Assad, I don't care who, and say, look, This is a broad stroke alliance. We're not signing any treaties, but hey, like, we're cooperating to destroy jihadi Islamism in the Middle East, and we're all on the same basic team when it comes to this. Because we won't say that because it's politically unpalatable to be anything pro Iran or pro Assad or pro Russia. But the reality is, that's already true. We're fighting the same battle. The problem is America just can't decide which battle it wants to fight. So we fight everybody, right? We're fighting Iran and Russia over influence. We're fighting Assad because he's a humanitarian disaster. And, you know, we're fighting everybody. Plus, we're fighting ISIS. And, oh, by the way, what are we going to do about the Kurds? And, oh, by the way, what are we going to do about Turkey?
Yeah. I mean, the only thing I would add to that is we need to host that conference, get everybody in the room, walk out, the Americans leave, and lock the doors behind them. You guys solve it. We're going back to North America, where we're from.
Absolutely. Russia has way more to be concerned about in Central Asia and the greater Middle East. Way more. Because guess what? It borders Central Asia. It borders the former Russian republics. And it borders the Russian Federation southern republics that are still within the Federation that are majority Muslim. And oh, by the way, the Caucasian or the white population of Russia, the white Russians, they're actually decreasing because of suicide, alcoholism, and bad birth rates. And the Muslim population of Russia is skyrocketing. They are facing a demographic disaster and crisis in their future. Russia is and should be way more worried about terror in the Middle East than we should be across our pretty oceans.
Yeah, and we should also recognize that Henry Kissinger doesn't understand economics. He knows what's good for Rockefeller interests. But this whole oil standard for the dollar and all of this, or American security and dominance in the Gulf necessary to make sure that oil resources can continue to get to our markets and or our allies' markets, especially, for example, our Asian allies who import oil in great quantities from the region, all that's all wrong. That mercantilism is stupid and wrong and was debunked in 1776. We don't need that at all. We could stay home in North America and we could rely on the fact that no matter who is in power in the Middle East, they have nothing but the incentive to put that oil to market. And if it came to, I don't know, what the Russians, who absolutely don't have the budget for this, but let's say they decided they were going to come and try to dominate the Middle East the way America has tried to all this time, we have nothing to lose whatsoever. I mean, I'd feel bad for the people of the Middle East, but hey, they wouldn't be any worse off than under American rule. But it wouldn't cost the American people or our economy anything. It might cost Exxon a few jobs and a couple of dividend checks for their stockholders, but that's not the national interest. That's a special interest. And that's no reason to stay and have a policy of dominance in someone else's region. And then, of course, there's Israel, as you mentioned. We can never even say anything that recognizes the reality that the Iranians are on the opposite side of the terror war from Al-Qaeda and on the same side of it as us. And because if you listen to not just the Israelis, but just read the National Review, that the Iranians are jihadists. What are you talking about, Danny Scherson? Same difference. And by the way, didn't we tell you that Iran has been in league with Al-Qaeda all along? Yeah, why not?
Right. And that's all, of course, all the evidence points in the opposite direction, right, about Iran and Al-Qaeda. And that, you know, that alliance is as fake as the Saddam Al-Qaeda alliance. And you know what's interesting about Israel in Syria? And I wrote this in my latest article on Syria. Israel, like major pundits and former like generals and defense secretaries or defense ministers in Israel have gone on the record during the Syrian civil war and said, if the choice is between Iran and the Islamic State, I choose the Islamic State. That was one quote. And the other quote, which was like to me even even more shocking, was like an op-ed that was, or was actually more like a policy analyst. But it was public, and the headline was the destruction of the Islamic State is a strategic mistake. An Israeli former government minister allied with the Netanyahu government wrote that. I mean, Israel would rather back jihadism in Syria so that they could fracture Syria, right, and weaken it, then have Iran have any influence there, which it already has. I mean, it's incredible. Like, Israel, if it was all about ideology, if it was all about, hey, Islamists are barbarians and they're coming for Israel and they're going to bomb our people on buses, if it was all about that, then there's no greater ideological and physical threat to Israel than ISIS or Al-Qaeda. And yet, they're more concerned about Iran, and it's staggering. It is staggeringly, it's absurd, and it makes no logical sense unless you realize what Israel is really about is none of the above, and they are really about dominance and major, you know, regional sort of geopolitics and realpolitik. They're not really worried about the things they say they're worried about.
Hang on just one second. Hey guys, I ever tell you about LibertyStickers.com? It's just nothing but anti-government propaganda for the back of your truck. I invented most of them, the good ones anyway. Anti-war stuff, anti-cops, making fun of all the candidates in the upcoming election. LibertyStickers.com. Hey guys, check out the great lineup of podcasts we've got going on over at the Libertarian Institute. There's me, Foreign Policy in Focus with Kyle Anzalone, Free Man Beyond the Wall with Pete Quinones, a.k.a. Mance Rayder, the Liberty Weekly podcast with Patrick McFarlane and Keith Knight, and our newest edition, Jen the Libertarian, with Jen Monroe.
Check them all out at libertarianinstitute.org.
Hey guys, don't you think it'd be cool if you could go to college, but Tom Woods was the dean of the thing? Yeah, well, something like that. Check out libertyclassroom.com, where Tom Woods went and had his pick of all the best professors to teach their courses in the real history and economics that you didn't learn when you went to college the first time around, or maybe you didn't learn because you skipped your higher education altogether. But here's some real American history and some real economics, the kind of stuff that you've been missing. It's all at libertyclassroom.com, and make sure to click through the link in the right-hand margin of my website, scotthorton.org. Hey, man, listen, as long as we're on it, let me go ahead and play this clip. It's Michael Oren, just a couple of months after he had left his position as Israeli ambassador to the United States. Maybe it's half a year later or something. But it's the end of June 2014. In other words, just 2 weeks after the Islamic State invaded Western Iraq from Eastern Syria, sacked Mosul, and just, I guess it would be 1 week then since Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi stood up on the balcony and declared himself the Caliph Ibrahim, leader of the Islamic Caliphate there. And there was the Aspen Ideas Festival. And Michael Oren sat up on a stage with, of course, Commissar Goldberg, of the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic and Israel's enforcer in the American media here. And Oren explains why he prefers the Sunni side to the Shia. And you'll see that he makes explicit references not to some mythical moderate groups as deniability, but to the Islamic State. Check it out.
And what I'm going to say is harsh, perhaps a little edgy. But if we have to choose the lesser of evils here, the lesser evil is the Sunnis over the Shiites. For the reason
you're
I mentioned
before.
You're
not speaking for me.
Okay. It's a lesser evil. It's an evil, believe me. It's a terrible evil. Again, they've just taken out 1,700 former Iraqi soldiers and shot them in a field. But who are they fighting against? They're fighting against the proxy with Iran that's complicit in the murder of 160,000 people in Syria. You can just, you know, do the math. And again, one side is armed with suicide bombers and rockets. The other side has access to military nuclear capabilities. So from Israel's perspective, you know, if someone's got, if there's got to be an evil that's going to prevail, you know, let the Sunni evil prevail. And again, I'm speaking entirely for myself.
Mm-hmm. As if he just said, from Israel's perspective, meaning the perspective of the Netanyahu government. And again, he makes an explicit reference to ISIS massacring 1,700 Iraqi Shia Air Force cadets at Camp Speicher. So we know he's talking about Baghdadi and the worst of the worst of the worst than Al-Qaeda guys, the Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Zarqawi's successors, who had then at that point seized all of Western Syria and Eastern Syria and Western Iraq and created their own Islamo-fascist caliphate straight out of Zionist propaganda from just a few years before that could have never existed in the world if not for America's policies for Israel in Iraq and Syria. And then here he's just, and then what's his excuse, Danny, that Assad is responsible for every single death in the Syrian war when he's fighting against a bunch of foreign-backed mercenaries in the first place? But then secondly, that Iran has military nuclear technology that they could transfer what to Assad and Hezbollah, which is just completely ridiculous. That's like saying Danny Scherson has secret military nuclear technology. It's just not true.
The whole thing is nuts. You know, it really leads one to some conspiratorial thinking, because Israel's goals and interests, as he just laid them out, are totally at odds with American supposed goals and interests. Like, we do not have – people are always like, oh, they're the only democracy in the Middle East. Like, we share cultural values. They just mean white skin. But the thing is – and they're not all white skin. But the thing is that our biggest threat purportedly, right, what we say ostensibly is the biggest threat to America is transnational jihadism, right? Transnational terror. Okay, well, which side – is more, you know, has more proclivity to international terrorism? The Sunni jihadists under the banner of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. When was the last time an Iranian Shia or a Shia anybody hopped on a plane, came to the United States and blew up a building? You name the time. You can't. Iran has presented no transnational threat to the United States for decades. It never did. There are no Shia suicide bombers in America. I'm not saying they didn't exist in Lebanon. I'm not saying they didn't fight the Israelis with those tactics. I'm not saying it didn't go on. Obviously, they killed our Marines in Lebanon. Of course, our Marines shouldn't have been there in the first place. But this is ludicrous. Israel and the United States are literally at complete odds strategically, and yet we're like dragged along by the three Bs. You know, I call them the three Bs that are dragging U.S. policy along. Benjamin Netanyahu, Bibi, MBS over in Saudi Arabia, and MBZ over in the United Arab Emirates, even though he's a junior partner. The three Bs are like pulling American policy, and it makes no strategic sense. But you know what? The United States, our policy in the Middle East has never, that's the dirty secret, it has never actually been driven by rationality or strategic sense or concerns about our homeland. It's never been about that, which is why I get into this sort of conspiratorial thinking, because there's no way around it.
Well, look, you know what? The best advice a guy in my cab ever gave me was, you know what, kid? Everything you say is right, except it ain't conspiracy. It's just politics. That's what it is. Politics is just the fight over who controls the resources. That's all it is, man. And so, you know, in other words, there is no national interest. There's just the individual interests of the people with power and, you know, what's good for them in their short term. You know, just like the public choice theory kind of a deal. Special interests is what Ross Perot used to call them. He's like, what does that mean? That means, yeah, squeaky wheel gets the grease. And so if the other 300 million Americans have to suffer as a result of whatever policy favors some tiny number of them, oh, well, that's, you know, the name of the game. That's how it's played. So, of course, you know, people who put Israel first are going to do everything they can to support Israel's interests. And if you don't like it, you're just supposed to play the game harder and better. That's all.
And if Trump is truly the man of the people, I mean, again, we're going back to this, go to the people. Trump could easily be like, hey, white ethnics from the Rust Belt who've been struggling economically and feel like you're culturally being taken over. Like, I don't buy that theory, but that's their theory, right? And he could say, hey, Rust Belt, you know, lower middle class working folks, guess what? The wars in the Middle East, they don't help you. They hurt you. The only people who are helped are the people who already have money. Money begets money. So it's the Israel lobby and it's the arms industry. Go to the people and say, listen, Rust Belt, listen, you know, Detroit, you know, white flight society. Like, these wars do not help you. They help your bosses. They help the people who put you in this predicament in the first place when they, you know, I mean, that's the answer. Like, whether you agree with Trump and the sort of like white Rust Belt narrative, which I think is flawed, use it, right? Use it, because those people are with him. They're with him. They're like, yeah, this is bullshit. What are we doing? No one's making any money off this except Exxon and Honeywell and, you know, AIPAC. Because that's, you're right, it's special interest. It's not the American, there is no such thing. You're right, there is no such thing as the American interest, you know? Everyone always talks about it. Even I get sold into, you know, I find myself using the phrase, and it's silly, I shouldn't. I should be more careful with my language, right, with my vernacular. But the reality is there is no, you know, there is no such thing as the American interest. That just doesn't exist. One could argue it really never has.
Well, the thing of it is, if you're a powerless person like you or me, then you can imagine what it would be like to try to do what's best for the country as a whole. It's just that the economics of politics, as Obi-Wan Kenobi calls them, preclude that kind of thinking. Essentially, all the incentives are built in separate and different ways, where most of everything has to do with keeping your lip buttoned up so you can try to move up so that maybe someday when you're 63, you'll, you know, someone close to the president will listen to you say one thing one time or whatever. This is, you have crazy incentives in the way that power is divvied up and the way that people play into that system. I'm sure you've read Daniel Ellsberg's book, Secrets, and I know you know from your own experience in the Army all this time as an officer and everything over there, but in Ellsberg's book, Secrets, he goes, look, the Gulf of Tonkin was a crazy conspiracy theory that wasn't taken seriously and very few people believed. And the secret was kept by approximately 40,000 people until I leaked the Pentagon Papers in 1971 after it was way too late, 7 years later, you know. And 40,000 people were willing to go along with that because what was the opposite of that? Going to prison? Discrediting their boss and all their coworkers who are all going to have to suffer for the scandal of them telling the truth and all of these things. And so the national interest, what's good for the people of Kansas in the war in Vietnam, it just doesn't play into it. It certainly couldn't override the individual interests of the people in power that we would be counting on to provide that check and balance. All of their business requires that they go along rather than stand up.
You're absolutely right. I mean, Ellsberg is the closest thing we had to the American interest. I mean, if special interests were keeping the warfare state going, you know, Ellsberg was the closest thing people like him to blowing the whistle on the whole thing and saying, whoa, I'm here to speak for the American people as their proxy because I've got some insider knowledge. And the reality is this isn't good for Kansas. It's not good for Detroit. And it's not good for Southeast Wisconsin.
Right.
You know,
and according to him, he was 10 years late.
Oh, of course he was. I think I've heard him express regret that he didn't turn sooner, you know, publicly.
In fact, I'm afraid to say that the way he's talked about on the show, he still does not forgive himself for waiting as long as he did.
Yeah, and I don't either. I mean, I'm not as an important of a figure, but like the great regret, the great shame in my life is the amount of times that I re-upped, you know, that I decided to stay on longer because I either convinced myself that, yeah, I'm one of the good ones and I'm going to fix the system from the inside, or when I was really being honest with myself, I really like socialized healthcare that I have and I really like that I keep getting promoted and like I make about $100,000 a year serving the empire and I can't do that in the outside world as easily. I mean, that's my great shame and regret. And I've expressed it in articles, you know, that's like I've thrown the mea culpa out there. I'm not as important as Ellsberg, but I understand the sentiment because I feel it myself.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, I mean, Ellsberg is Ellsberg, but you're pretty damn important. You know, your voice really resonates because, as I said in the introduction, you know, who are you to judge? You were there. You lost your guys in these fights and could see, you know, your previous article before the Syria one here is stop pretending Washington and Kabul never really controlled rural Afghanistan. And you were a team leader out there in the Kandahar province, right?
Yeah, and I threw a personal vignette in there because I think the readers kind of respond to that sometimes better than my more like esoteric, you know, evidence-based analysis. I mean, look, I tried my hardest in charge of 120, you know, conventional U.S. scouts working together with a Special Forces A team, and I raised a goddamn militia. I was the first conventional unit to do what the Special Forces were doing. I was literally the first one in Kandahar province ever. I mean, like generals. I mean, I can't tell you how many generals came to visit my camp. 3-star, 2-star. Every week a general come down because they wanted to see what I was doing. They used to call like, this is the laboratory for victory. Like what you're doing down here is the model, Danny. Like I got so much accolades for it. And the reason I told the story about how it was ultimately a failure is because I think it's important. And I knew, and that's what I say in the article. I said, listen, I knew at the time that raising this militia, while it might in the short term help protect my soldiers by putting like someone in front of the enemy that keeps them further from my base, because we were under siege up till then. So yeah, it worked for a year. It got my guys out of Dodge, most of them, right? Most of them and most of their limbs, not all of them and not all of their limbs. But I knew, I wasn't stupid. I said, unlike my peers, I didn't buy it. I knew what I was doing. I knew that it wasn't gonna work. But I didn't care because I was trying to get the hell out of Dodge with as many of my guys and their legs as I could.
Yep. Well, and from the general's point of view, well, talk about that. What it's like to be a general with a base out there, to be a general with a major like you out there, and the politics and the incentives from their point of view, because you want to talk about knowing better. These are the guys who know better.
Yeah, or they should, but you know, the problem is with the military promotion system, like the thing that is most valued, okay, in promotion, the thing that is most positively reinforced in promotion and success is not measurable outcomes. It's PR. What I mean is a can-do attitude, positive thinking, and shining up a turd and showing it to a general is how you get accolades. I mean, if you were to read my evaluation, my officer evaluation report, my report card for Afghanistan, it's glowing. It's glowing. You would think I won the war in Kandahar province. I mean, if you read it, you'd be like, wow, this guy's a big deal. I was nothing. I failed All I did was briefly lower violence against my troops. All I did was put an Afghan in front of my problem. I didn't solve the problems of Kandahar province. I solved the problems of B Troop, 4th Squadron, 4th Cavalry, 1st Brigade, 1st Infantry Division. That's the only problems I solved was my own. I didn't fix anything. I didn't win the war. But these generals, they come down. The thing is, I was able to present it to them as this great success, right? Because I had these statistics that we keep that show like, well, see, look, attacks on my base are down. And so they come visit because, A, they love to glad hand with soldiers. It makes them feel like fighting generals like George Patton. I mean, I had one general, he used to keep this is true, he became a 4-star in Iraq, and he used to come visit troops, and he used to keep a baseball bat tucked into the back of his body armor, like Leonardo from the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. But, you know, Patton had his pearl-handled pistol. Well, General Thurman, that was his name, he was the 4th Infantry Division commander at the time, he used to roll around with his baseball bat, like, I'm a badass general, I'm a soldier's general, I'm going to come see what the boys are doing, I'm going to shake hands with them, and I'm going to talk shop, and I may even have a cigarette with them, you know. And it's like, they come down, and when their real job should be, wait, let's think of this. Like, can this be done? Is this long-term? Is there any real solution? What's going on? Instead of that, they, like, just come down and they, like, laud you and they shake hands with your troops. They pin a few medals on some kids and they fly away in their helicopter. These generals who were lauding me, who were saying that my province and my troop was the laboratory for victory and that we had to expand this ALP militia program all over the country, they would spend about 30 minutes with me. They never went on a dangerous patrol with me. Every once in a while, we'd take them on these, like, staged foot patrols. Because the general's aide would call me the night before, right, and say, oh, General so-and-so, General Higgins from the 82nd Airborne is coming down, right? That's a real guy. And he wants to go on a patrol. He's going to have a photographer with him. There's a picture of me and him actually online, if you Google me and then go to images. And but, like, the aide also says, like, but he doesn't want to die. Like, so don't, like, take him on a patrol where you might get shot. So I would literally, like, stage a patrol route through, like, the safe part of, like, my area, like, right outside the base. And it was literally a photo op. I mean, this is – and, you know, he would come for 30 minutes. He'd spend – you know, he'd come for 45 minutes, spend 15 minutes putting on medals, saying nice things to me and shaking the hands of my soldiers. And he'd spend 30 minutes walking on a patrol with a rifle like he's a real soldier, you know. Mm-hmm. And then he'd get his helicopter and fly back to Kabul or to Kandahar airfield.
Yeah. Yeah, see, this is, again, why it's so important. Nobody else can really attack these guys except an officer like you who's been there in that kind of way. Otherwise, anybody else would just be ignored or – shamed right out of talking. But I remember back in the 1990s listening to Colonel David Hackworth on the radio, and he hated every other officer. You know, his job essentially, and he was a colonel in Vietnam, of course, but the most decorated officer in the Vietnam War. But essentially his job was to fight for the enlisted men against the government, meaning the Pentagon, the officers, the real military, as opposed to the American people, the infantry, you know, the enlisted men. And he hated them. I remember he used to just ridicule Wesley Clark and call him the perfumed prince, which, you know, if he had lived to, which he died of Agent Blue bladder cancer, by the way. But if he had lived, what he would have had to say about David Petraeus and the rest of these kooks up there, like you're talking about this guy, strutting around and essentially pretend, like, acting a part like they're in some movie. When what they're really doing is getting their men, as they put it, their men killed over nothing, their boys killed over a bunch of garbage. And even when they know better and everybody knows that they know better or could. And this is where I wanted to bring up Carl Eikenberry here, who was, you know, the ambassador for a time. But previously, he had been the general in charge of the war. And he finally said, this is crazy. We should leave. We should not do the surge. We should get out instead. And that goes to show and really prove what you're talking about with the rest of these generals, that they at least should know better. If Eikenberry can be as good as he was, which he was pretty late in terms of when he came forward, but still, if Eikenberry can do it, then any of these guys could have done it. Any of these guys could do it right now. And I wanted to mention, too, this guy, it was in the Washington Post. It was a member of Obama's National Security Council, I'm pretty sure, who said, we have to take this deal because I think the way he put it was, if we had taken the deal 5 years ago, it would have been better. 10 years ago, it would have been even better than that. 5 years before that, it would have been even better than that. If we do it 5 years from now, it's going to be even worse. whatever we can get now is as good as we're ever going to get, guys. Now, that is some pretty damn pessimistic words in the Washington Post from a guy from the previous administration whose team helped to lose this war, saying, hey, fess up, face up to it. There's no point in keeping going because we just can't pull it off. And so, man, what a horrible truth for the rest of these people to be so obstinate against and refuse to concede. But, I mean, how unfair is that to the infantry? Get out there and be the last man to die for, not a mistake, something that everybody knows is a fraud.
And that's the thing about Trump. Like, he could do that too. He could say, not only is it not good for you in the Rust Belt, but hey, I love the soldiers, I love the veterans. Hey, you. Hey, infantryman with a bunch of tattoos, you know, who has a high school education and very few prospects when he gets out of the military. Hey, infantryman. Hey, Marine. This war's not good for you. I'm going to get you out of it. I'm going to get you out of this nonsense because these wars, the generals make careers on them, but you're in the mud and you lose your buddy, you know. And look at Eikenberry. Look what happened. This is instructive. When Eikenberry turned, late as it was, but it's never too late, when Eikenberry turned, he was pilloried by his former comrades. He was persona non grata. He was blackballed. I know this because I know generals, okay, currently generals, I can't use their names, on active duty who have told me that he was blackballed socially by all his former professional mates. When he said no to the surge, the war is – all the other generals turned on him. That's instructive to me. And I just want to tell one other story, actually, going back. I'm kind of going back, but like I think that you and the listeners will find this a little bit interesting. So I told you that the generals would come down and they would do these like mock patrols. Well, one time I told you we had to make sure they don't get shot at. One time it didn't work. So let me just briefly tell you this story. I think it's also instructive about how fake this is and about how these generals are frauds. The con men, really. We had built this little market. Actually, I had paid some Afghan contractors to build this little market, but in this really dangerous spot. And I told the boss, and oh, by the way, when you pay the contractors, they kick back to the Taliban. So I'm actually funding the Taliban by doing this. And I knew that. And I told my boss. So I told my boss, this colonel who wanted to be a general, which means he doesn't care about his troops. I said, hey, this is not a good place to put a market because like no one's ever going to actually go there because it's so dangerous. And like, this is a step too far. Like we're a step too far away from the base. Like this isn't going to work. He was like, no, we're going to build a school here. We're going to build this market. It's going to be thriving. With your new ALP militia program, you'll be able to protect it. I was like, nah, not really. So we built the structure, the superstructure of this market, right? And we like literally paid and cajoled a few Afghans to like bring some stuff in there, make it look a little bit like a market. And then the assistant division commander of the 82nd Airborne, St. Clair, who eventually, by the way, leaves the military under nefarious circumstances because he like sleeps with his aide or something, right? But anyway, St. Clair comes to visit me, right? And he's a big deal. He's a one star. He's a climber. He's in the 82nd Airborne. And I'm told by my colonel, like, oh, like you need to take the general. He's coming tomorrow. We need to take him on a walk through the market, you know, and like we'll take him on a stage patrol. And I said, sir, to my colonel, who is a sociopath, and I still hate to this day, not going to use his name, but I kind of want to. Anyway, I said, sir, this is bad. We're going to, like, there's a good chance we'll get attacked. Like, there's a good chance someone will die tomorrow. Like, this is not good. This is not the typical patrol that we do. Like, I'm telling you, I know the ground. You visit it every once in a while. I live there. Something bad's going to happen. He's like, no, it's going to be safe. It's your job to make sure it's safe. I said, okay. The enemy gets a vote, sir. I literally said that. Hung up the phone. The next morning, we go on this little patrol. We come under RPG and machine gun fire. And I have never seen a general hit the deck and jump into a canal and get himself wet and dirty so fast. And thank God none of my soldiers were hit. It was a brief firefight, but it was dicey and it could have went the other way. General goes home in his helicopter. He still lauds me, still says nice things. You could see that he was shaken. Hey, we were all shaken. I mean, for me, it was every day. For him, it was like once a year. But when I got home, okay, when I got back to my base, that night my colonel calls me. Guess what happened? I got lit up. I got yelled at because I let the Taliban attack. I got yelled at for what the Taliban did. I said, this is a fraud. You don't want to win this war. If you wanted to win this war, you would have listened to what I told you. And I mean, I got in trouble because it didn't look good that the enemy got a vote. I'm like, should I have called the Taliban up ahead of time? I should have. I should have made deals with the Taliban. I swear to God, I should have. I should have been in such a relationship with the Taliban that I should have paid them a few hundred thousand dollars. I had sacks full of money, literally. I should have taken it home.
And you're paying them taxes anyway, like you said. So.
Right. I should have met with the local Taliban and been like, hey, what's up, dude? Tomorrow I'm taking this general around. Like, we won't f*** with you for, like, the next month. Just, like, don't shoot at us tomorrow. I should have done that because I got yelled at for not doing it, essentially. Now, if I would have done that, they would have fired me if they found out, right, and all that. But the reality is that's what they wanted. They wanted a safe patrol. Well, I can't make a patrol safe unless I bring the Taliban in on the deal. I mean, it was insane, but it's true.
Yep. Well, and, you know, I only found out after I published my book that there's an entire book that was written by a guy who was in charge of this stuff over there, where that's exactly what they did, was pay protection money to the Taliban, and the Taliban would even provide the security, driving the truck in front and back of the convoys of gasoline and other materials that American soldiers needed in the surge, and paying them millions and millions and millions of dollars in taxes for their protection in order to fight the war against them. And then they just spend all that money buying guns that we gave the Afghan National Army on the black market and use them against our guys. And just goes on and on. In fact, the best story here was Aram Rostam, the guy that wrote the book on Chalabi, had a piece in the Huffington Post about how there was a guy who had his own little Afghan Blackwater mercenary group, and he would contract with the Taliban to provide protection services for the convoys. And he was the son of the Afghan defense minister at the time, and even opened up a lobbying firm on K Street in Washington to help lobby for the surge and the extension of the war.
I mean, there's so many stories like that. I mean, I was just thinking as I was telling you that story, like, why have I never written these stories down? Like, I need to write like a short book that's just a series of vignettes that are instructive on how absurd the war is. I mean, the word absurd would have to be in the title somewhere, you know, or some.
It could be like your American History for Truth Diggers series. You could do a series where it's just goofy that happened to me during the war, you know.
You know, I'll talk to Eric. You know, maybe I'll start publishing those. Like, maybe I'll do like an extra article a month for Anti-War where I do exactly that, because I know that you guys would totally support that. And
oh, absolutely, man.
You know, I'm glad we had this conversation, because I'm going to do it. I mean, the only time I've ever told these stories is like over like too many beers with like my buddies who were there with me. Like, and I think the people need to know.
I bet you could write a great Catch-22 type novel there, you know?
Absolutely. I lived Catch-22. You know, what I'm describing is very Catch-22, isn't it? Like, generals coming down, going on fake patrols. One day it goes bad. I get yelled at because the Taliban decided to be the Taliban. Like, you know, it's insane. I mean, the whole thing is insane. And what you're talking about with, like, the money and the corruption, like, look at Ahmad Wali Karzai, right? The half-brother of Hamid Karzai. He runs Kandahar like a narco state. I mean, the guy is the most corrupt dude. He's got ties to the Taliban. He's got ties to the drug dealers, right? And this is the government we're backing?
Yeah, like, he's a half-brother of the president that whole time.
Yeah, the president puts his brother, who was a known criminal before the war, he's long been like a criminal with nefarious ties to drugs and the Taliban, and like, we throw that guy down there, and he runs Kandahar like a private fiefdom and just uses American troops to prop himself up. We weren't in charge. He was in charge.
Well, and when the Taliban killed him, they replaced him with Abdul Razak, who was also a heroin dealer and became the most powerful warlord in Kandahar.
Who I have met, talked to, walked on patrols with.
And he's the guy who finally got shot and killed when the Taliban assassin tried to kill the American general there that time. And there was that firefight in that closed room. That was just a year ago or whatever.
Oh,
right?
By the way, Razak was a known war criminal. He got put in charge of the Taliban. it might as well be. He got put in charge of the Afghan National Police in Kandahar, in charge of the whole thing while I was there. And I met him. I was at the ceremony where he got like promoted or whatever. And I walked on a few patrols with him. He's a scary dude. Like, he is he's a badass. Like, don't get me wrong. He's a monster, but he's a badass. Like, when you talk to him, he is not scared of you because you're an American. He talks down to you because he's older than you. And he wasn't even old, but he's older than me. He talks down to American lieutenants and captains and majors. Like, he thinks he's the because he is. And the thing is, he was a known war criminal already. Okay, I showed my colonel an article in Harper's from like 2009, right? Okay, an expose on Razak. You can look it up.
It's by Matthew Akins, right?
Yeah, right, about how he executed all those not only Taliban but also civilians, like in a ditch, like years before. Well, 2 years later, I find out Razak's coming in to be in charge, and everyone's all excited because he had a reputation as a Taliban ass kicker, right, which was somewhat true. And I showed my boss, who didn't give a shit and could barely read and couldn't spell Afghanistan. I was, look at this article from Harper's. Like, we got a war criminal coming in. Is anyone else concerned? And I was literally told, like, shut the fuck up, Danny. Why are you such a troublemaker? I mean, I was like, this is public notice. This is in Harper's. And we knew he had a war criminal coming in. And guess what he did when he came to Kandahar? Committed more war crimes.
Yeah.
And also worked with the Taliban. So, yeah, he's a Taliban ass kicker who also runs drugs, which fuels the Taliban. It's really a beautiful system. I mean, the absurdity of it. It's almost like trying to fight against the system, like I was in my limited way, it becomes Kafka-esque.
Yeah.
There's no other term for it.
Well, and think about this too, where, you know, we're talking about how there's no national interest when it comes to these policies in the macro sense. I mean, here you are in Kandahar province saying, listen, here's what's good for the war effort. Sorry, it contradicts what's good for your career at this moment. However, and their answer is, shut up, Sherson. You're getting in the way of what we're doing, which is their eye is not on the ball. Their eye is on their own. And so there's the economics of politics, even at the micro level. You know, the major gives sound advice to the colonel. The colonel says, get the hell away from me. I don't want it on the record that you told me that you knew better.
I got to run here in a bit, you know, but this has been a great conversation. I want to tell one more story about how this is really more about promotion for these guys than it is about the war effort. Same guy, same colonel. His name was Lieutenant Colonel Katona. He was a monster. I hope he's listening. He's not. He doesn't read. So anyway, he says he wants to go on a patrol to this really distant outpost that I had established that got attacked every day. It was literally like a sandbag Alamo. And I was like, I didn't even want to establish a place. I wanted to give it up because all it was a death trap for my guys. It didn't actually provide any security. But whatever, I had to keep it because he said, keep it. He's like, I want to walk there. I was like, sir, we got to take a helicopter. Like, that's the most dangerous walk in Kandahar province. Like, I've never done that patrol without being attacked 3 to 5 times. He was like, no, we're doing it. And we're doing it tomorrow because I want to go see the soldiers out there. And I was like, oh, you're such a hero. Okay, well, here's the deal, sir. If you insist, we must leave before dawn because the Taliban doesn't like to fight at night. They don't like to get up early. They're the laziest fighters ever. We have to leave at like 4:50 a.m. We might get there without a firefight. On the way back, we are going to be attacked, so I recommend a helicopter. But if you insist, we have to leave before dawn. He says, Danny, you know my battle rhythm. I go to the gym in the morning. I go to the gym every morning at 7. The soldiers expect to see me in the gym on my little big safe base. And if I'm not there in the gym, they're going to think that their boss doesn't work out with them. So we have to leave at 9. That's the earliest I can get here. I said, sir, if we leave at 9, someone's going to die. And luckily no one did, but it was a close thing and a lot of people got hurt. And he goes, Danny, let me give you some advice. And I said, oh, great. Sage advice from this sociopath. He goes, quote, Danny, in this business, lower caters to higher. We're leaving at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Massive firefight within sight of my base. We couldn't get 600 meters away from my base before we came under massive RPG and machine gun fire. I was hiding behind a rock pile with him, which was the only cover we could find. And I remember looking in his eyes, and he was a sociopath, so he wasn't even scared. He's one of these guys that you just know a bullet's never going to touch him, and he knows a bullet's never going to touch him. He was brave in a sociopathic, psychotic sort of way. He's not scared, but I look in his eyes, and I lock eyes with him, and the hatred I felt for what he had just put my guys through, for the fear I felt hiding behind a pile of goddamn rocks again, unnecessarily this time, right? The point I'm trying to make is the point I've been making with all these vignettes, and I'm going to write them down from now on once a month or once every couple of weeks, is that the war was never about what they said it was about. Even for the military guys, even at the mid-level management of like colonels, it was never about winning. It was about putting on a show. It was about PR. It was about career advancement. And I'll never, ever forgive him or them for those decisions that they made. Yeah. Because again, it was my silly scouts who graduated high school 18 months before who were bearing the brunt of that. It was, you know, it was a radio operator who had graduated high school not even a year before who once told me that he was scared to die because his friends had died and he had never had sex with a girl before. Okay? He was 18. Those guys are the ones who lost out, not the colonels, not the generals.
Yeah. And it's been like this the whole time. And then, so back to the beginning again about the narrative. Well, geez, you know, General Jack Keane says we can't leave now because a bad thing will happen and all of this. And these individual young men that you're talking about here, really boys, as you're saying, you know what? Lower caters to higher. You know, Lindsey Graham and his people, they have beliefs that need reinforcing or something. So, and you know what? It's the numbers are down, but still young men are not stopping joining the infantry. They've got the supply, and their dads and their uncles and their teachers and their ministers and their coaches and everybody tells them that this is the right thing to do. Even though everybody knows this is the era of the phony wars. This is the era of lies and wars. But it doesn't matter. If you're wearing, you know, that desert brown or that olive green, then that's good enough. That means you're absolved of all sins. That means you can do whatever they tell you to do and that it's still honorable to do it. It's still the right thing to do it because the whole question of where you're going and what exactly you're doing and to who is not part of it. It's not even part of it. The only question is, are you serving your country and loving your flag and being responsible and learning how to shoot a rifle and a bunch of garbage that has, well, it's not all completely garbage, but it's mostly garbage in the sense that it's, you know, a red herring, right? It's all the wrong questions being asked and answered instead of who are you sending me to kill and what the hell threat do they pose to my family back home, if any? So
yeah,
it'll
right.
keep on going like this, and then I guess they'll find out after the fact or late in the game that, I guess my coach doesn't know what the hell he's talking about, does he?
Nope, and that's the thing. You know, everyone in their life system tells them that they're doing an admirable thing. No one actually questions what they're being sent to do, and they'll still be on the Jumbotron, and they'll still get to board first on an airplane, and they're still going to get someone to pick up their check in TGI Fridays in the airport on their way to another losing war, and they're going to come home, and they're going to be a mess, and you know what's going to happen? They're going to be like, it's going to be like Major Shorson on his way out of the military after 18 years carrying war for the Empire, and where does Danny find himself in his last official duty as a soldier? Inpatient rehab in Arizona for PTSD. That's the thanks you get. And I was a major, which means I didn't even have it as bad as the squad leader or the machine gunner. But that's the story. That's the end state. And I think it's absolutely ridiculous. And I'm personally insulted, and I will never forgive.
That's why you shouldn't. All right, guys. That's Danny Shorson, former major in the U.S. Army, author of Ghost Riders of Baghdad, and regular columnist at truthdig.com and at antiwar.com. Again, his last two articles are We're Listening to the Wrong Voices on Syria and Stop Pretending Washington and Kabul Never Really Controlled Rural Afghanistan. Thank you again, Danny. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott. Great conversation as always, bud.
All right, y'all. Thanks. Find me at libertarianinstitute.org, at scotthorton.org, antiwar.com, and reddit.com/Scott Horton Show. Oh yeah, and read my book, Fool's Errand, Timed and the War in Afghanistan at foolserrand.us.